Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. What does it take to get through a pandemic? How do you keep going, keep working, get up every day, and hope for the best? You need to be resilient. But what does that mean? I called up the most resilient person I know, my friend, psychologist Dan Gottlieb. He was in a car accident 40 years ago and has been in a wheelchair since. He's a quadriplegic. He's been to the hospital with different health issues more times than he can remember. So I wanted to ask him, how does he think about resilience?
My introduction to resilience was right after my accident. And, 40 years ago, I went to the physical therapy gym and I saw all these broken bodies and I wanted to turn my head. I mean, there were stroke victims and quadriplegics and paraplegics and amputees. And I just didn't want to look. And all of a sudden, I heard laughter coming out of the corner of the room. Somebody was laughing with their therapist. Somebody cracked a joke. And I said, my God, look what these people are living with. And how can they laugh? P.S., it was about a month or two later, and there was laughter coming out of my mouth, too.
When we find ourselves in a situation like the one we're in, the thought that often comes to mind is, I can't do this. There's no way I can do this.
Sure you can. How many times in my practice have I heard people come in who've just experienced, physical or emotional trauma and say to me, how am I going to live with this? And my answer is, look in the rearview mirror and you'll find the answer, because you will live with it. But you don't know how yet, and you're going to learn how. We pursue life. Every cell in our body pursues life.
So we can look at previous difficult situations and realize that, oh yeah, I got through that.
Every single one of them. I say to my patients, how many times have you been knocked on your butt? And, the numbers are pretty big for grown-ups. And how many times have you gotten up? And the answer is always every time. We are far more resilient than we think we are. We're stronger than we think we are.
But why do you think is it always that we think, oh, I can't, I cannot possibly do this? I mean, that's always like the default reaction, right?
It is. And if I can translate that, the internal dialogue is something like, I'm afraid to do this. I don't know if I have the coping skills. When we talk about fight or flight, there's one in the middle, and that's freeze. And that's what you hear. I'm frozen up. I can't do this. I don't have the tools. And what we have to do is unfreeze ourselves.
How do we unfreeze ourselves and get through this situation? On this episode, a look at resilience, what we're learning about it as a psychological concept, and what resilience looks like during this outbreak. Resilience means recovering after a setback. A lot of athletes are used to that. You have a great game and then a terrible game, a big win and then an injury. But right now, many are dealing with a major setback of a different kind. The Olympic Games have been postponed for a year, and that means the world's best athletes have to be resilient in several ways. First, this is a big disappointment. And second, they have to figure out how to keep their bodies in top shape to perhaps have another chance at the Games a year from now. What does that process look like? Jad Slaman looked into it.
For a while after her run, Nia Akins could do nothing but just stare at the numbers, big and bright on a digital display board. 2.00.71.
Nia Akins with the huge victory.
I think I just kind of sat there in disbelief after running for maybe a solid couple minutes, just kind of like looking at the time and not thinking that I'd run that.
That was back in February at a track meet in Boston. Nia had just run 800 meters, about half a mile, in 2 minutes, 0.71 seconds.
When I thought about the Olympics before that day, I think I thought, you know, it was more of a pipe dream.
Nia is a middle distance runner at the University of Pennsylvania. She says it's a bit mind-bending to imagine you could be better at something than anyone else in the world. But that time on the board, it was hers, and it was the second fastest in NCAA history.
After that, I kind of thought, like, why not really go for it and really train as though I believe that, you know, I could be top three at the Olympic trials and I could be a potential contender at the Olympic Games. I think then was when I started to dream a little bit crazier.
That performance made her a favorite for the U.S. team at Tokyo 2020. But not long after that race, slowly at first and then all at once, the coronavirus changed everything. International travel was restricted, bars closed, runs on toilet paper, we all know the rest. Finally, Olympic officials had to make a decision.
And we are following breaking news right now here on HQ. Reports from an IOC member that the 2020 Tokyo Olympics will be postponed until next year. This is what
the games would have been a global virus bomb. Travelers from all over the world in close contact for competitions, spreading the disease among each other before heading back home and spreading it more.
I don't think any of us could have ever imagined that it would happen the way that it's happening now in the U.S. and that, you know, I don't think we expected it to have such an impact on just our day-to-day lives.
Nia is still running, but things are different. It's all scaled back.
Right now, we're just training and training for the sake of routine. You know, we don't really know what we're training towards right now.
Normally, elite athletes like Nia would be working toward what's called peaking, reaching their absolute top shape. I talked about peaking with Mike Young. He runs a sprawling training center in North Carolina for all manner of super athletes.
BMX world champion last year, the number one U.S. decathlete, probably four U.S. track and field athletes, a world record holder in swimming, 11 women that played in the World Cup last year, including five from the women's national team.
They're all chasing this peak, trying to arrive at it at just the right time. Right at the semifinal match, the qualifier, the Olympics.
There's been people who have missed a peak and achieved a world record 2 weeks after the Olympic Games, and they didn't even qualify for the Olympic Games. And no one wants that. Ideally, you're looking to be at your best when it matters the most.
It can take months or even years of carefully planned training to hit the peak at just the right time. And the peak, he says, is doubly important in performance-based sports as opposed to team events. In events like Nia's 800 meter.
The ones that are quantifiable by meters, centimeters, seconds, milliseconds, that kind of thing. Kilograms on the bar. Those ones, you're really defining yourself on that last 1%. Because everybody that's at that level is pretty darn talented.
When the difference between Olympic gold and watching the winners from the sidelines is minute, every last bit counts. But Mike says athletes were struggling with how hard to train in the weeks before the Olympics were officially pushed back a year.
You don't know when you're supposed to be at the correct destination. You can't possibly design your training programs to arrive at the correct time.
It's like, were they pushing themselves for no reason, or were they not pushing hard enough? Now that the Olympics are pushed to 2021, there's a whole new timeline to get to the peak.
It's very hard to stay peaked.
That's Megan Cartafalsa, an athletic trainer at Penn. She says in track, most of the biggest meets are scheduled within this 2 week period.
That's like pretty much the longest you could possibly be at your highest elite level before your body needs a quick deload to reset, make the necessary, you know, physiological changes in the body and then build back up again.
Olympic feats may seem superhuman because they kind of are. keep the human body at the peak for too long, and Megan says you could start seeing injuries that you don't come back from. Strains, tears, stress fractures. The right way to train is to only chase the peak when it's useful and know that the next one is coming.
So it's, you know, it's peak, kind of level out, maybe diminish, build again, peak again. So it's a constant, like, ever climbing up a mountain, and then the mountain continues to go up and up and up.
Training has slowed down across the board for Megan's athletes. She does some physical rehab via FaceTime.
The mental aspect right now is probably the most challenging for these people, is to reset and understand that, you know, training isn't going to be a thing for, you know, maybe another month or two.
Elite athletes' whole lives can revolve around training, but with the pandemic, everything shut down, it's not possible in the same way.
Everyone's daily routine has been disrupted right now, and this is a perfect storm for athletes.
That's Joel Fish, a sports psychologist that's worked with a bunch of pro teams, Philadelphia Phillies, 76ers, Flyers, as well as a few Olympic teams.
You don't get to be an elite athlete unless you've developed a real discipline in terms of training for something today that may be an event that's going to take place 2 months from now, 3 months from now, 6 months down the road.
All that discipline, that drive, and nowhere to put it, Joel says it can be real distressing. He's had to deal with it when athletes get hurt or benched. He says the key is to work on what you can.
Positive self-talk, visualization.
Maybe go through the event in your head. Do different simulations. Imagine a bad start. Imagine recovering from it. Imagine crushing it.
Today's your day. You feel like a champion. Your body's like a well-oiled machine. You're moving swiftly. You're thinking clearly.
And Joel says it's important to separate yourself from your sport. Realize you're this whole other person. He tells me about a ball player he worked with who was benched with an injury.
He said to me, before this injury, if you would have asked me, who am I? I would have said, John Smith, the basketball player.
A year later, a year off the court, this John Smith took some courses, did a lot of reading, worked on the off-court John Smith.
Now if you ask me, who am I? What's my identity? I'd say, I'm John Smith, who likes to play basketball. Do you hear the difference?
Nia, the middle distance runner, already has another identity that she can lean on.
I think if you're only running, you know, you tend to overthink running a lot more, and that it kind of like consumes your life. And I think, especially now with this huge pause, I am very fortunate that I have nursing school to kind of take away from that, if that makes sense, and it is something that I can focus on.
That's right. If Nia wasn't already your hero for her feats on the field, you can add nurse in training during deadly pandemic. It's her senior year in the Penn nursing program.
Ardeen was really highlighting that this year, 2020, was the year of the nurse and the midwife, well before all of this started happening. And I just think it's funny how, like, with everything that's happening now, like, that is so true more now than ever, because, you know, we really have been kind of pushed to the front line because we are really the ones that are providing that bedside care. So I'm proud to be a nursing major right now, but it definitely is a scary time.
Nursing is what Nia's always wanted to do.
My first job, I was I took care of children and babies during church services. And I just absolutely loved it. You know, I thought, like, maybe that's what I want to do in life.
At first, she thought she'd work with kids. But after clinical rotations and studies, now she leans toward adult care.
I just really like taking care of people. And I also am, like, really interested in science, too. So I think nursing is kind of like the perfect blend of both.
Nia had been thinking about coronavirus basically since January, when it was still mainly a story in China. It was something they discussed all the time in nursing classes. So when the Olympics were canceled, it wasn't a shock. She's grateful the danger is being taken so seriously by so many. For the moment, the virus hasn't changed her plans about nursing.
I mean, I think for right now, I think I'm concerned about, you know, how my family will react to it. You know, if I do end up, you know, living with my family or, like, whoever I'm living with, I think I'd be more concerned for their safety than for my own.
And the virus, it didn't change her plans about running either.
Who knows, like, I don't want to put this in the universe, but, like, the Olympics could get postponed another year. Like, at this point, you just kind of, like, don't really know what the future holds. You never really do, but I think that's more, people are realizing that more now than ever. So I think I'm just going to continue, you know, doing what I kind of planned on doing. That's both nursing and track for right now.
I ask her, though, if she's worried the delay could cost her a shot at a medal, a shot at gold. Timing is so important in this sport, and she has something amazing right now. But the thing is, when she ran that incredible time in February,
wearing the colors for Penn, Nia Akins,
it was a complete surprise.
Akins is running away from this field that includes a world championship participant.
I mean, that was what was so unprecedented about my performance earlier this season was, you know, we weren't really training to peak at that point.
Akins with the win, just over 2 minutes.
Her trainers were just hoping she'd do well enough to move on to the next stage. They weren't aiming for or expecting this blowout peak.
We weren't really training to have a performance of that caliber then.
But now that she's done it once, Nia knows she can do it again.
I think that's something to look forward to even now, even during the COVID, is, you know, when this is all over, as long as I'm keeping up with training and everything, that, you know, like, that didn't disappear. It's just delayed.
Nia Akins with the huge victory.
That story was reported by Jed Slayman. Special thanks to Flow Sports for the audio from Nia Akins' race in Boston. Healthcare providers are facing massive challenges right now in caring for people who've gotten sick with the coronavirus while also being exposed to the danger of infection. Kate O'Connell is an ER nurse in Queens, New York, and she's also an audio producer. She's been recording what it's like to be on the front lines of this outbreak.
It's been very, very hairy at work. I am seeing things I cannot believe. It's like we're running a MASH unit, but without the blood and guts. It's all airway, airway, airway. When I left work today after seeing the next shift coming on, I looked at all my colleagues just hustling. It's just now getting easier to recognize each other as we are all wearing N95 respirator masks covered by paper surgical masks all day. And I felt such absolute tenderness for everyone. I felt like, hey, be safe. I want to see you again. There's nothing worse, nothing for me as a nurse, than to see a person struggling to breathe and to listen to the docs telling them, we may need to protect your airway. This involves sedating you and putting a tube down your windpipe and letting a ventilator do the work of breathing for a while. And they're just looking at you terrified. They can't talk because they can barely breathe. Their eyes say it all. Our ER has been divided into areas as best they can, with the non-COVID area getting smaller by the minute. Today, our entire critical hallway, all the trauma rooms, the regular ER, the fast track area, the observation area, were all just sick COVID patients who need oxygen and monitoring, several of whom are vented and waiting for ICU beds. Ideally, if we can stabilize a person on a non-rebreather 100% O2 mask or with BiPAP and prevent intubation and venting, that is a win. Our hospital's giant two-story lobby has been transformed into a fever clinic where people get a COVID test and are educated about how to manage symptoms at home. They are the walking well. They may be sick and febrile, but they should be okay at home. The area where we're seeing non-COVID emergency patients is an old ER waiting room tricked out with recliners, stretchers, and room dividers. So I had a guy who was crushed by an 800-pound piece of elevator machinery today. He's okay, a bright spot in a sea of misery. People still need the ER for those kinds of emergencies, heart attacks, strokes, seizures, etc. We have a nurse outside, literally out in the cold, doing initial triage on people coming in by car or walking. She splits the flow. But yet still, even amidst all this chaos, people still show up at triage complaining of headache they've had for over a year. Or I had the classic guy this morning who was so angry about how long everything was taking. I was like, sir, we usually would have 4 docs to cover this area. Today we have 1, because all the docs are on the other side of that wall taking care of very sick patients with COVID-19. He said, people don't get that sick. It's not that bad a virus. Everyone's exaggerating. Now, is Kate O'Connell going to take out all her rage on this insensitive nudnik who, as far as Kate, in her non-nursing hat, is concerned, can f*** right off? No. She's going to stick her tongue out at him behind her mask and apologize for the long delay and let him know she's doing everything she can to get him out of there quickly, Lucky that right now my hospital has enough PPE, personal protective equipment. I have a spare N95 mask, and today I got issued another at the start of shift, so I'm glad I have my own as a backup in case they run out. Reusing an N95 mask? Ha! I would have failed nursing school if I had ever condoned that. But these are strange days, guaranteed to get stranger hourly for the next several weeks. As I left work today, I heard the second overhead call within 10 minutes, 10, about a notification arriving. That's when EMS is phoned ahead to alert us to a critical patient on the way. I passed by the room where the first one went. An intubation was already in progress, and I saw EMS come flying in with the second note. And I just looked at my manager like, "Do you need me to stay?" She said, "Go, just go, but please come back. This is just the beginning."
That's New York ER nurse and audio producer Kate O'Connell. Together with Samantha Brown, Kate has produced a series for Transom. It's called Pandemic ER, Notes from a Nurse in Queens. We'll put a link on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. So what could nurses do to get through this situation?
I would think the first thing would be is that each of us acknowledge that we're as human as our patients.
I asked Donna Nikitas. She is dean and professor of nursing at Rutgers University in Camden, New Jersey.
We have to be compassionate to ourselves. It's not perfect right now. We understand that. We're under moral distress and sometimes frustration on not having the equipment that we need. But we have to use what we have at the moment. So to be kind to oneself so that that kindness could be shared towards others. The next one I would say is to be mindful throughout the day, to take a pause, a purposeful pause, and reflect. Where am I now? Breathe deeply, notice what's around me, relax your face, relax your shoulders, your hands and your legs, just to be present in the moment.
We're talking about resilience right now, looking at the healthcare system. Everybody's been thinking about the nurses and doctors working in hospitals, but primary care providers are also affected by this outbreak in a major way. Primary care practices play an important role as a first line of defense with our health, but the pandemic could threaten their survival. Dan Gorenstein reported on this for his podcast Trade-Offs, and he started with health clinics. They serve millions of patients, many of whom live in poverty. The centers get paid per office visit, per service, and right now, far fewer patients are coming in, which means huge financial losses. They're getting federal funds to help support them through this crisis, but it may not be enough to keep their doors open. One of the people Dan talked to is Chuck Jones. He heads Harbor Health,
a group of six health centers serving more than 30,000 people annually in Boston and on Cape Cod. I recently called Chuck the night before Chuck had met with his board of directors.
We've had to make a lot of difficult decisions recently. And at that meeting, I gave an update to the board about our financial situation, and we sought their approval to temporarily close Geiger-Gibson Community Health Center, the very first community health center in the country.
Harbor Health could not afford to keep Geiger Gibson open, even after closing down its dental facilities and furloughing more than 200 people, over a third of their workforce.
And so they gave me that approval, understanding the situation that we're facing right now. You know, what led to this decision, and it's every decision, you know, it affects. Excuse me.
Are you okay?
Yeah. It's a lot of
All right, let me start over. So this has really been sort of nonstop decisions, every one of which is a struggle between taking care of the people that built the organization and trying to ensure the survival of the organization itself.
So help me understand your finances. How many people pre-COVID, typical day, how many people are coming through the door? How much are you guys billing?
So on a typical day, 600 to 650 patients walk through the door. On a monthly basis, our health centers have about $3 million of total revenue. About 60 to 70% of that is revenue that's directly tied to the visits that are coming through the door.
Chuck says now with COVID-19, they're seeing 1/20th of their normal patient load in person with a bunch of virtual visits, a trend that has real consequences for their bottom line.
That puts us on a deficit track of about $1.5 million a month. You know, that's not something that can be sustained very long.
When you say that, Chuck, do you mean that you might have to just like providing the care to all these people, you guys might just have to close? You can't afford it anymore?
I mean, look, I was thinking about, I try to stay positive. I try to stay optimistic, but without something really significant happening on the out, you know, being introduced here, there's not a light right now at the end of this tunnel that I can see.
Community health centers care for some of the country's most vulnerable patients, but they're just one part of the primary care network that's feeling the strain of fewer patients walking in the door. The American Academy of Family Physicians says that many of its nearly 135,000 members report seeing half as many patients as normal and having just 2 to 6 weeks' worth of cash reserves in their practices. By June, the group estimates 60,000 family practices will close or be significantly scaled back, and 800,000 employees will be laid off, furloughed, or have their hours cut. About a quarter of primary care docs work for a hospital, insurer, or other corporate entity, which, in theory, will help absorb this financial shock. But for the independent practices, conditions are fast reaching a breaking point.
These practices have razor-thin margins.
Farzad Mostashari runs Allidaid, which works with more than 500 independent primary care practices nationwide.
We asked our physician practices what were their top concerns. And on that survey, the number one concern was they can't get their masks. They can't get personal protective equipment. Their supply chain is broken. The second biggest fear was this devastating their practice finances.
Farzad says one of the practices already had to lay off 12 staff members. Others are seeing more than half of their appointments canceled, not to mention staffing shortages due to the outbreak.
I mean, we have one practice where the doc is the one who's the revenue generator for the whole practice. And she was exposed and is in quarantine, and the whole practice is shut down and they may need to lay people off. It's literally that degree of fragility to some of these practices.
If these practices close down, Farzad, what is that going to mean for the country's larger efforts to contain coronavirus and keep people as healthy as possible?
We're going to have people at home who still have high blood pressure and are still at risk for stroke and heart attack and kidney failure. And a real concern is that if we snap that thread of primary care, that the actual death toll could end up being far higher, not just the direct impact, but also the indirect costs that it's incurred into our nation's ability to care for the most vulnerable.
How many independent primary care practices are there in the country, do you know?
21,299.
Do you expect all of them to survive this?
No.
If primary care practices are forced to close their doors, the evidence suggests it won't just hurt patients and staff.
The strength of our primary care system is critical for the health system overall.
Meredith Rosenthal is a health economist at Harvard who studies primary care.
And Meredith, what needs to happen to support primary care providers during this pandemic?
What needs to happen for those practices may be some cash flow support, maybe some additional flexibility in terms of payments for telemedicine, emails, phone calls, text. If we lose primary care capacity, almost surely that will have a detrimental effect on patient health and on the cost of care overall.
That's an excerpt from the podcast Trade-Offs, hosted by Dan Gorenstein.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about resilience, what it means, and why we need it. In the beginning of this year, reporter Liz Tung brought us the story of David Fagenbaum, who had nearly died several times from a rare illness called Castleman's disease. It has features of cancer, but it also causes the immune system to attack vital organs. David got this diagnosis when he was a third-year medical student. Every time he came close to death, he became more determined to live his life to the fullest. Every setback became a lesson in resilience. He reconnected with a former girlfriend he loved, Caitlin. He stayed in school. He was treated with a high dose of chemotherapy and an experimental drug. Things seemed to stabilize, but then his symptoms returned. Let's listen back to the story from here.
David was scared, so he flew back to Little Rock to talk with his doctor.
I said, okay, well, what next? Like, what other drugs are in development? And he said, there aren't any other drugs in development. I said, okay, well, what sort of promising leads are there? Are there cell types? Are there, like, things that we can target? And he said, no, there aren't.
It was David's fourth relapse, and what would maybe become his most important lesson yet. If he wanted a cure, he'd have to find it himself.
If I was going to hope for a drug or pray for a solution, that I would need to turn my hope into action and that I would need to start fighting back and start to try to identify drugs and treatments that could maybe help me and other patients.
So David dove into the research and pretty quickly realized there was a problem. There were just a handful of Castleman's researchers around the world, and none of them were talking to each other. As one of David's friends told him, what Castleman's needed was a quarterback. And that's something David knew how to do. Back in Philadelphia, he launched a two-pronged campaign. Along with his doctor, Fritz Van Rie, he created the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network, a foundation dedicated to connecting Castleman's researchers and facilitating the development of new drugs. At the same time, he threw himself into laboratory and clinical research, using himself as a subject. Illness aside, it was a fertile year for David. He graduated from medical school and got engaged to Caitlin, was pushing forward his own research and cultivating a global Castleman's community. He was starting to feel hope. And then, once again, the symptoms returned. Fatigue, abdominal pain, night sweats, all the same as before. They should have been easy for David to recognize, but this time he just couldn't.
I was still in denial. I was like, you know, it can't be a relapse. I've only been fighting this, you know, working on treatments and trying to identify something else for about a year. And like, I haven't made enough progress yet. Like, this can't be it. I need more time.
David was virtually out of treatment options. There were no more experimental drugs for him to take. And he was approaching the lifetime maximum of the heavy dose chemotherapy that had saved him in the past. And worse than all that, an important deadline was looming.
And at this stage, I was engaged to Caitlin, and I wanted to make it to our wedding date more than anything. It was 5 months from our wedding date, and that's all I could think about. I could just make it to May 24th, 2014.
In the end, the high-dose chemotherapy again served to tide him over. But David knew it was just a temporary fix. The clock was running down, and he needed a Hail Mary pass if he was going to survive.
And then I really dove into my data. I dove into the samples that I had, the experiments I'd been running, the data that I'd been generating, to try to identify some sort of signal within the data that could maybe identify a drug that already existed. I knew I couldn't develop a new drug. That would take 10 years and $1 billion, but maybe I could find something in my data that would suggest that something was wrong, where there was a drug that already exists that could target that thing.
Over the next few weeks, David pored over thousands of pages of his own medical records, along with data from the experiments he'd done with himself as the subject. What he was looking for was a tell, that one irregularity that might be the key to his illness. It was like finding a needle in a haystack. And then, one day, he spotted it. In data taken several months before his last relapse, he saw that his T cells and a specific immune system molecule were out of whack. After more tests, David figured out the connection between the two, a cellular communication line called the mTOR pathway. David had a hunch that if he was able to shut down that communication line, he might be able to prevent his immune system from overreacting.
But I knew that there was a drug called sirolimus, and this drug was developed 30 years ago for kidney transplantation. It had never been used before for Castleman disease, but I was out of options, and so I decided to try it on myself as the first patient with Castleman's.
David took the leap. In January of 2014, he quit taking his other drugs and started taking sirolimus. It was a gamble, but one that ultimately paid off.
Today, it's now been almost 71 months. I think it's like 71.92 months. I can't round up. I don't know if I'm going to make it to 72 months. But I also won't round down because, you know, we worked really, really hard for each portion of this remission.
These days, he leads a research lab at the University of Penn, where he went to medical school. And he and Caitlin have a daughter, 1.5-year-old Amelia, who's just starting to walk. David ended up turning his experimental cure into a clinical study. So far, it's shown that sirolimus helps 30% of patients go into remission. It's a major win, but for David, not quite enough.
We constantly have patients come into our lab reminding our team of, you know, why we do what we do. And, you know, all I have to do is touch my chest and feel my port, which is where I get chemotherapy, to remind me, like, things feel really, really good and I'm doing really, really well right now. But I know where I've been and I know what's kind of below the surface. And so that just motivates me to keep working harder and harder and harder.
But now at least there's a roadmap for how to find them. There's the research being done by the Castleman Disease Collaborative Network. And of course, there's David's own Hail Mary approach, the discovery of which helped deliver David's fifth and final lesson.
With this fifth time I nearly died, I think the biggest lesson that I took from it is that solutions can sometimes be hiding in plain sight. This drug that I'm on was in my nearby neighborhood CVS for all of those years when I was in and out of the hospital, spending months hospitalized, but no one had ever thought to try it. This drug was just sitting there on the shelf. Of course, behind the counter, it's a prescription drug, but no one had thought to try it. How many other drugs are there out there? How many other solutions are there out there for diseases and for other industries where they already exist, just someone has to find it?
Since Liz reported that story in January, a lot has changed, and we asked David how he's doing now. On the plus side, he said he gets to spend more time with his daughter.
Come here. Hey, honey. Amelia, last time you were on the pulse, you had just started saying mama and dada. You had just started seeing mama and dad.
David has to be especially careful because the drugs he has to take suppress his immune system. But once again, he wanted to be part of the solution. His lab at the University of Pennsylvania had been studying immune hyperactivation, or cytokine storms. It basically means your immune system is going into overdrive and doing more damage to the body than the invader it's trying to fight. This occurs in Castleman's and also with some COVID-19 patients. When David realized this, he was hoping that labs would start to look at ways of treating this immune hyperactivation.
And then I found myself saying, wait a minute, you know, if I'm going to hope that someone out there does it, we've got a lab that's focused on this and we've got people who are committed to making a difference in other patients' lives. And so why don't we just do it? So a few weeks ago, we assembled a team, a 30-member team of volunteers, some of which are scientists in my lab, some of which are volunteers who are citizen scientists, so they don't have formal training, but they wanted to get involved. We extracted data on over 5,000 COVID-19 patients. And now we have what I believe as of right now is the world's only central database that lists all the drugs that have ever been tried against COVID-19. And we're currently doing analyses to understand what drugs are working and what drugs are not working.
We'll put a link to David's COVID-19 work on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. When you hear stories like this, like David's, it can feel like resilience is an individual trait, something that you either have or you don't. Canadian resilience researcher Michael Unger says that's not true.
It's not just an internal quality. It's not just about grit or mindfulness or self-regulation. It's also about whether or not these qualities are triggered by the environments to, in a sense, bring out our best and boldest selves.
In other words, resilience is a skill that is fostered by our families, our communities, and we have to invest in it and build it up over time.
It's what we've done before the crisis, which is going to have a huge predictive value in terms of what we're going to experience during the crisis. So, you know, it's things like, for instance, having this coronavirus pandemic occurring right now. From a resilience point of view, what we're clearly seeing is that when there are really great healthcare systems, government systems, faith in our scientists, when we have tight communities, even a sense of our own culture, all these other factors in our lives that are sort of there before the crisis occurs, those are the things that are actually highly related to which people are going to survive this the best. I'll give you, I mean, a very playful little example, but on my street that I live, we've spent a fair bit of effort in getting to know our neighbors, and we tend to have potlucks periodically throughout the year and this type of thing. And recently, one of my neighbors who owns a chain of restaurants, you know, he's really struggling because of this. So all of our neighbors got together one Sunday evening and we ordered takeout from his restaurant. And then we held a virtual potluck using Zoom technology. And it was great. Not only did it bring the community together and support one of our neighbors financially a little bit, what it really spoke to was that the fact that we had already invested as a community in these social networks, and that when we were all kind of feeling down and slightly, you know, distant from each other, suddenly those that effort that we'd put in before became so powerful, and it in fact creates that resilience in the moment. And I'm going to argue that, you know, that there are these resources, these things that carry us through complex times. And then the more of those that we invest in building these resources, the more likely they are to help us when we're in a crisis.
Michael says during difficult times, what really helps people is having a routine.
One of the things we know from studies of post-tsunami, post-wildfires, post-natural disaster, it's absolutely essential to get people back to work, or if you're talking about children, it's one of the first kind of mental health interventions is to get children back into school.
That's Michael Unger. He researches resilience at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Canada. A lot of us are trying to stick to routines, getting up early, working hard, working out. It helps us feel a sense of normalcy. But Aisha Ahmad says, don't use frantic productivity as a way to ignore the vast shift that is happening right now. Aisha is a professor of political science, and she's lived in conflict zones all over the world. She wrote this essay, which she recorded for us.
I've observed a common response to the COVID-19 crisis. My colleagues and friends are fighting valiantly for a sense of normalcy. Everyone wants to know, when will this be over? When will things go back to normal? The answer is simple and obvious, yet terribly hard to accept. The answer is never. Global catastrophes change the world, and this pandemic is very much akin to a major war. Even if we contain this crisis within a few months, the legacy of it will live with us for years, maybe decades to come. It will change the way we move, build, learn, and connect. There is simply no way that our lives will resume as if it had never happened. And so, while it may feel good in the moment, it's actually foolish to dive into a frenzy of activity or obsess about your productivity right now. That's denial and delusion. The emotionally and spiritually sane response is to prepare to be forever changed. This journey of acceptance is challenging, and so I will offer some insights from my experience in other disasters. Take what you need and leave the rest. Stage 1, security. The first few days and weeks in a crisis are crucial, and you should make ample room to allow for mental adjustment. It is perfectly normal to feel bad and lost during this transition. No sane person feels good during a global disaster, so be grateful for the discomfort of your sanity. At this stage, I would focus on food, family, and maybe fitness. You will not become an Olympic athlete in the next 2 weeks, so don't put ridiculous expectations on your body. Know that you are not failing. Let go of all of the profoundly daft ideas you have about what you should be doing right now. Instead, focus intensely on your physical and psychological security. Stage 2, the mental shift. Once you have secured yourself and your family, you will feel more stable and your mind and body will adjust and you will crave challenges that are more demanding. But don't rush or prejudge your mental shift, especially if you've never experienced a disaster before. Abandon the performative and embrace the authentic. These human transformations will be honest, raw, ugly, hopeful, frustrated, beautiful, and divine. Let this change how you think and how you see the world. Stage 3, embrace a new normal. On the other side of this shift, your wonderful, creative, resilient brain will be waiting for you. Things will start to feel more natural. You will be comfortable about changing or undoing what is already in motion. New ideas will emerge that would not have come to mind had you stayed in denial. None of us knows how long this crisis will last. The uncertainty is driving us all mad. Of course, there will be a day when the pandemic is over. We will hug our neighbors and our friends, return to our classrooms and our coffee shops. Yet we are just at the beginning of that journey. For most people, our minds have not yet come to terms with the fact that the world has already changed. Yet we can let go of our fear and embrace radical acceptance. On the other side of this journey, our hope and resilience. Because calamity is a great teacher.
That's Aisha Ahmad. She is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Toronto. Her essay was first published in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and we'll put a link on our website. This is The Pulse, and we're talking about resilience. How are kids dealing with all of this? Not going to school, not seeing their friends, their parents, all kinds of stressed out, and not knowing when this will end.
Taking a long time for it to go away.
We asked a bunch of kids to tell us what helps them get through their days.
My name is Lucas. I'm 7 years old, and I live in Maryland. How I'm facing these hard times is by most sometimes doing things that I enjoy, but also sometimes doing work. I'm doing like an hour and a half of educational things called like Khan Academy. It's this thing that my dad helps me with. It's a lot longer with him because he really wants me to get every single thing right. Yeah, I think that's how I handle it.
I get to play on the PS4 with my friends online. And I get to play basketball with my dad, and my mom makes me delicious meals 3 times a day, every day.
Jelly sandwiches.
Staying inside and having Lego sets.
Stay in the house.
Hubby makes me stay in the house.
I play with my toys. I go outside like I am right now and just hang on the porch.
Family, being alone.
And talking to my friends.
And I get to read books with mommy.
And painting.
I would be actually really happy to go back to school. I miss all my friends, like I'm sure a lot of people do, because, I mean, like, these are hard times.
We've been talking about resilience, and we started the hour with psychologist Dan Gottlieb, who I always think of as a super resilient person. I had one more question for him.
If you had sort of, not a battle cry, I feel like we have too many war metaphors going on anyway, but if you had a sort of a saying that people can say to themselves or to remind themselves, like, we are resilient, what would that be?
Well, it could be something like, think of how good your butt feels when you stand up after being knocked down. But
it's not very philosophical, but I'll take it.
It's the way I roll, Martin.
Yes, you do.
I get knocked down.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tong, Jed Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Sabrina Ems. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation,
an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.